Magnetic monopoles have been studied in grand unified theories. People are less familiar with the fact that there are magnetic monopoles in the standard model as well. So this picture, in this picture, these red and blue dots are supposed to represent monopoles and anti-monopoles. These are genuine magnetic monopoles in the sense that divergence B is not zero. They are confined magnetic monopoles, and confined in the sense that they are connected by these purple lines, which are strings of the Z magnetic field. So those strings, unlike solenoids or Dirac strings, they have nothing to do with electromagnetism. Z and A are orthogonal fields, and so these are electromagnetic magnetic monopoles, but connected by Z. So it's like if you have quark and anti-quark, but they can be connected by QCD strings. So it's a bit like that. And such things do exist in the standard model. And of course, from the magnetic monopoles, there is some electromagnetic magnetic field sticking out. So the structure is that you have a monopole, electromagnetic field, but then a string which connects it to an anti-monopole. So if you have such objects formed, say, at the electroweak phase transition, then you might expect in any volume to be filled with the gas of these monopoles, antimonopoles, which are connected by strings. And then, of course, the strings like to pull the monopole and antimonopoles together. The monopole, antimonopole annihilate, but what you're left over with is some residual magnetic field. So this is a scenario. And the magnetic fields, that if there's any residual magnetic field with large coherence scale, then that is frozen into this plasma, which has high conductivity. So here's the proof that magnetic fields are frozen in. Here's Maxwell's equations, and then this is Ohm's law in a plasma. When you combine these equations, then you get dB by dt is this term, which is called the advection term. So this term just carries the magnetic field around. If the plasma has velocity, then this magnetic field goes around with it. Then there's a diffusion term, and then there's this displacement current term. But in any case, this is suppressed by 1 over sigma. And sigma is the electrical conductivity. And usually, these plasmas have high electrical conductivity. So this term is dropped. And this just means that the magnetic field is carried around in the plasma, and the field is frozen in. This is actually not strictly true. There's a diffusion time scale here. And basically, what we are saying is that the diffusion time scale is much longer than the Hubble time scale. So this is how you might expect magnetic fields to come out of electroweak phase transition. And as I go through the seminar, you'll see things getting much more complicated. So of course, the question is, how many monopoles were there? How much magnetic field survived? On what scale is it, right? So we have very little control over these questions. But there is a way out. The way out is that let's consider a reaction in which baryon number is violated. So you start with baryon number 0, then something happens. You go through some object called a sphaleron, and then baryon number is non-zero. So this is the picture that you have baryogenesis, say, at the electroweak phase transition. It turns out that this sphaleron is nothing other than a monopole, anti-monopole, bound state solution. But the catch is that it's not just a monopole, anti-monopole, but there's some twist of the monopole. So, So whereas if you just had a monopole antimonopole, they would like to collapse and annihilate and go away. Instead, you have a twist which effectively provides a repulsion. And so the repulsion balances the attraction, and you have a solution. And this solution is called the sphaleron. And indeed, you can calculate the magnetic moment of the sphaleron. It is 0.314 inverse GeV. And of course, it's 100 times much larger than the magnetic dipole moment of the W. So the sphaleron is nothing other than the monopole-antimonopole bound state. So this is very useful because the sphaleron is supposed to decay, and what you can do is to, so the sphaleron is supposed to be the saddle point solution in the standard model. And then you have two different vacua, and these vacua carry different, what is known as Chern-Simons number, of essentially, you might think of it as baryon number. So in going from one vacuum to the other, you produce baryon number, and you have to go over this hill, so the top guy is a sphaleron. And what you can do is that you can look at the decay of the sphaleron, and you can model this path in field space, and you can find the electric currents that are generated as the sphaleron is decaying. So that becomes J mu. And then you just solve Maxwell's equations with this current for the decaying sphaleron. And you can calculate the helicity in this electromagnetic field. The helicity is defined to be integral A dot B. And this is a function of time, because as the sphaleron decays, you're producing the decay products involve magnetic fields. And the decay path is known, but you don't know how fast it is flowing down this decay path. Well, or rather, I should say, a decay path is known and has been explicitly written down. It's just that you don't know how fast you're going down that path. But it will turn out that the asymptotic value of this helicity seems to be independent of what function you choose to go along the path. So when you before I calculate that, let me just point out another interesting result by Jakeev and P. If you look at the evolution of helicity in vacuum, then there's a very simple argument which shows that the final helicity has to be half the initial helicity. So let's say you start with some electromagnetic configuration. You can Fourier transform it. So AK are the modes. You can calculate the helicity. Since it's A dot B, you get a cosine squared KT. And the cosine squared is 1 plus cosine 2 kt. But now when you take t to infinity, this term drops away, and you're left with the 1. But this is nothing other than the initial helicity at t equal to 0 times a half. So if you have vacuum evolution of electromagnetic tangled electromagnetic fields in vacuum, then the asymptotic helicity is half the initial helicity. Of course, in our case, the situation is slightly different. At the sphaleron, there is no helicity. There's no electromagnetic field, well, or very minor field. So in our case, when we calculate the current along this path and then the electromagnetic fields, we get zero helicity, goes down to a minimum, and then it comes back up. And it's this is about half of this. Okay, so what you find is that as the sphaleron decays, you're going to produce helicity, and you can estimate the helicity as minus is for baryon production. So if you produce baryon, then you produce left-handed fields. Sine squared theta W by G squared. G is the SU2 coupling. So this is also an important point, that baryon production implies left-handed magnetic fields.
So,
all right. So
the That's related to the approximation that the magnetic field is just affected. Is that right, or is that independent?
Yes. No. That.
It needs to be the case that the magnetic field is just.
So let's see. The conservation of dH by dt.
A related question is.
Is E dot, sorry, let me just, E dot B, and then E is something like J by sigma. So if the electric field, if it goes to zero, then your dH by dt is zero. Yeah. Okay, but in this case, every Bayesian number that you produce produces a certain helicity. But then that makes it really easy because you just count the number of baryons and you get the amount of helicity. And so the helicity density is minus because it's mostly baryons, some proportionality constant, which I don't know, but you expect might be one. And number density of baryons divided by alpha. Alpha is this e squared by 4 pi. But when we did some simulations, we found that this number was rather small, 1 by 100 or so. So really, the relation is like H is minus NB. It's even simpler. So you just have the baryon number density, and you know the helicity. So that's kind of cool, I thought, that you relate magnetic fields in the universe to the baryon number density of the universe.
So I know that I can define gauge and baryon. If I follow flux tubes or I define my box in the correct way, but I thought that gauge invariant helicity densities were just not possible. So this means that you've made a choice about how you.
No. Sorry. Maybe this is not A dot B. This is by the density, I mean H is 1 over volume, and you're integrating over some volume. This is what I mean. So I think there still is an assumption there that the surface magnetic fields are.
There are some.
Yeah. Okay. So now I want to complicate life a little more and talk about the chiral magnetic effect. Because this seems to be relevant for cosmic magnetic fields. So what's the chiral magnetic effect? Let's say you have an external magnetic field, and you have fermions in the plasma, fermions and antifermions. So you have left-handed particle, maybe left-handed antiparticle, right-handed particle, right-handed antiparticle, so on. Right? You have four states. And they all have some magnetic moment. These are fermions, charged fermions. So let's say they like to line up with the external magnetic field. But if they like to line up, then the magnetic moment is the charge times the spin. And so their spins are lined up in certain ways. For example, here it flips. Here it stays the same, here it flips, here it stays the same. But since these are chiral particles, like you assume that, let's take them to be massless. So then momentum is lined up with spin, depending on whether it's left or right. So in this case, the momentum is going down. In this case, it's going up, up, down. But if the charges are moving, then they are carrying a current proportional to the electric charge. So again, this gets flipped up. So the left L minus current is going up, and this is going up. These two are coming down. So now, depending on the numbers, you will get a current, which is the number density of this L minus, minus the R plus, minus the R minus, plus the L plus. So these two are plus and these two are minus. So, so now if there's a difference in the number of left and right-handed particles, then you will get a current proportional to the magnetic field. Okay? And so it'll have an E squared, a delta mu, which is the difference in chemical potential of left and right-handed particles, and the magnetic field. Of course, if the particles are massive, then it doesn't make sense to talk about helicity. They can flip, and this current will be diminished. But let's, for the time being, just take this this current. So that's the chiral magnetic effect, which is that if you have chiral particles and antiparticles with a slight excess of one chirality, then you will get a current along the magnetic field. There's also a chiral vorticity effect, which is that if you have a vertical motion, then you have spin orbit coupling, and say the spins are lined up, then the momenta, some of the momenta are opposite, which means that your electric currents point in different ways. And then you get a current by the same kind of logic. You get a current along the vorticity of the fluid, but now it goes as delta mu squared, which is mu L squared minus mu R squared. Okay. So, so these are two chiral effects which might play a role in the early universe. So the chiral magnetic effect seems to be an important effect because you also have the chiral anomaly, which is, by the way, this work is by Boyarsky et al. And there was an earlier paper by Joyce and Shaposhnikov who had a lot of these ingredients. So the number of left minus the number of right-handed particles, that changes. And that change is basically given by the rate of change of the helicity in the magnetic field. So that's the chiral anomaly. And basically, the NL and NR can be written in terms of the chemical potential, the mu L and mu R that I was talking about. So now, when you put the Maxwell equations together with the Ohm's law and the chiral magnetic effect, you get an equation such as curl B is sigma E. This is Ohm's law. And then there's this additional current due to the chiral magnetic effect. So now what happens is that from Maxwell's equations, you can write an equation for the helicity in the magnetic field. So this is the rate of change of the helicity. And here, there's also a mode expansion has been done. And then that is proportional to minus k squared hk, which is coming from diffusion. And then this is the chiral magnetic effect. And the chiral anomaly tells you that the rate of change of this chemical potential difference, mu L and mu R, is given in terms of the rate of change of the helicity. And then there is some flipping that can diminish the difference in chemical potential. So what Boyarsky and all et al. Did was to solve these equations. They took B, the initial B, to be that's produced by baryogenesis, and then they could solve these equations. And what happens is that they find that the magnetic field is amplified. So this is what they show in their paper, the initial spectrum at 100 GeV, so this is very high temperatures. And then as the universe cools, you get a peak in the spectrum. If you ignore the chiral magnetic effect, then the peak would be here somewhere. So it's just damped. But here you get amplification. So recently we've been looking at the role of, so what Boyarsky and all did was to ignore the velocity term. What recently we've been doing is to include the velocity term and assume that there's some turbulence in the medium as well. Okay? So in this case we get these four terms. Here is the advection term, here is the diffusion term, here is the chiral vorticity effect, and here is the chiral magnetic effect. So it's a little more complicated. But one thing you notice is that on the right-hand side, there's this term, which of course doesn't depend on the magnetic field. So even if you start with B equal to 0, you will get some magnetic field purely by the chiral vorticity effect. So we've been looking at this equation. This is ongoing. And so briefly, our results look like this, that this is the velocity spectrum. So on small scales, we take a Kolmogorov spectrum for the velocity. And on large scales, we assume a white noise distribution. And so the velocity is getting damped as time goes on. And the magnetic field, which was 0 initially, develops a peak, this dashed line over here. And the peak moves to the left, which is to larger and larger scales as time goes on. And similarly, the helicity develops a peak. Now, I should say that, this is a very complicated problem because it has these four terms, plus it has the Navier-Stokes equation for the velocity field and all this. It's a complicated system. So we have made some simplifications, like throw away the advection term for time being, and we are doing this analysis. But I'll come to that in a minute. But what we also find is that the helicity grows and then saturates at some time. And the chemical potential sort of is constant, but then it decays apparently to some tracking kind of solution. And we're not quite sure we understand that tracker yet. This is the thermal scale, so it's a very small scale. Yeah. That would still be very small, but I'll come to that in a minute. So the other thing, so since the V cross B, the curl V cross B, is the nonlinear term, we have not included it. I mean, we are not MHT experts. We don't pretend to be. But what we can do is that after solving, we can compare the various terms and see if the advection term indeed is small. And here in this case, which is for a certain mode number here, log k is -6, we find that the advection term is down here, and it is small. But at a little larger k, the advection term starts becoming important at this temperature. So I don't think one can trust our result all the way, but maybe for us some amount of time we're doing okay. Okay. So if your magnetic fields are helical, you can also cause an inverse cascade, which is transfer of power from small to large length scales. And here people have done numerical work, which shows that the length scale grows as t to the half. And there have been some analytical arguments for growth of t to the 2/3. This is in flat spacetime. So now, if you work in an expanding spacetime, you'd have to replace t by the conformal time, tau, And then what you get is that C equals as T to the alpha by 2, where alpha is either half or two-thirds or something in between, we don't know. It goes as T to the alpha by 2 in radiation and T to the alpha by 3 in matter. Okay, so the length, sorry. The inverse. To the small scale. So I don't think, I mean, the Kolmogorov spectrum we assume in the last work, I mean, it was just sort of disconnected with this, was for the velocity field. Right. But in general, if you have kinetic helicity or something, then it may not be true. I don't know what happens in that case. Maybe someone else does.
But a different question. In MHD, the helicity is conserved.
In MHD, the helicity is conserved, yes. But these other chiral effects are not part of MHD.
Okay.
Okay, so if I assume one of these exponents for an inverse cascade, then I can work out the length scale, assuming some initial length scale, right? C injected, and then there is some expansion factor due to the universal expansion, and also some inverse cascade, which is a power alpha. And when I work through the numbers, I get something like 0.1 kiloparsec today. So this is still very small by when you compare it to, say, galactic scales or cluster size scales. But still, it's not a tiny atomic size length scale.
So the original peak reported through was the thermal scale right after the electric
vacuum? So let's see. So here I took the initial to be a centimeter. The centimeter might be the horizon at electroweak. Is that right? So the point is that if we put it in a phase transition setting, then you expect bubbles to collide, and so you might have a typical scale, which might be some fraction of the horizon. So I just took the horizon for simplicity. Okay. As for the field strength, if you think about the helicity alone, then we know that the helicity is something like the barrier number density, but the helicity is the correlation length times the magnetic field squared. And so this gives you an estimate today of 10 to the minus 21 Gauss. So this is a very weak magnetic field. But there is a follow-up. The follow-up is that in this estimate, I assume, I mean, this is just based on helicity, and I am assuming that you only have barrier number production. Okay? In reality, you might expect that there will be, sometimes you'll produce baryons, sometimes antibaryons, but there will be a slight excess of baryon-producing transitions. So in that case, sometimes you'd produce right-handed fields, sometimes you'd produce left-handed fields, but there'd be slight excess of left-handed fields. And perhaps that plays a role. I'm not 100% sure. But in that case, you can get a huge amplification factor. It depends on if you add them up sort of at random, then gamma, this exponent, will be a half. And you might, you can gain by several orders of magnitude. So this is not closed yet. We don't know the answer, but there will be some enhancement, but it's not clear how much. Okay. Now let me actually say a little bit about observations. And since there have been several papers on this, so one way to possibly observe intergalactic fields is by TEV gamma rays that come split up into E plus E minus, and the E plus E minus then get bent in the in a background magnetic field, and the GEV that they are supposed to emit and you should be able to see are missing. So basically, if you have TEV gamma ray sources without the surrounding GEV halo, then you think that they might be magnetic fields. So this was a claim that the Fermi data gives a lower bound of 10 to the minus 16 Gauss on magnetic fields. There was another claim that they've actually measured the magnetic fields at 3 times 10 to the minus 16 Gauss. But there has been some discussion of this. And in this case, I think there was a counterpoint that they didn't really take into account the point spread function of the telescope. And also, Phil Chang gave a talk at ASU, and maybe Avery is, that a magnetic field is not the only way to get rid of the GEV halo, but you can have MHT instabilities that can also give rise to the absence of GEV gamma rays. So I think I don't know, what's the verdict?
We're looking for the gamma rays.
I see. Of course, if there's any handle on magnetic fields, then this is very exciting. But if it fails, then there's nothing we can do. Okay. So the Fermi looks for gamma rays. So they see some TEV sources. And the usual thinking, the earlier thinking, I should say, was that if you have a TEV source, then it should be surrounded by a GEV halo. And the only way to get rid of that GEV halo is by having some intervening magnetic field. So if you don't see a GEV halo, then it means that there's a magnetic field, and you can put a lower bound on that magnetic field. And so there was some Fermi data which showed TEVs, but they didn't show GEV halo. And so these people put a lower bound of 10 to the minus 16 Gauss. But Avery and his collaborators are saying that there are other instabilities which can get rid of the GEV halo.
What is the angular size of this TEV energy?
Maybe Avery is in a better position to.
So the halo you'd expect to be, you look for the halo if you want a direct detection of GEVs that are bent around. That looks like a halo because it's a long distance before the TEV gamma ray pair produces. It makes the upscatter. If you didn't have a magnetic field, then you ought to see a GEV point source fairly near the TEV point source. It would be a very weak. The problem is the TEV emission is beamed. And so you only have to bend those produced pairs a little bit out of the line of sight before you don't see them. So it would look like a point source.
Okay.
Apparently, it's enormous distance.
All right. So then the other possibility to detect the primordial magnetic fields is in the CMB. And the earlier literature mostly focused on very coherent magnetic field. Let's say you have a magnetic field which is constant throughout the universe or uniform throughout the universe. The idea is simply that you have a source, and it's very faint here, but let's say there's some polarization, and then as it comes to you in a magnetic field, the polarization rotates. But it rotates in a frequency-dependent way. So by looking at many different frequencies, and you see some rotated this way, some more, you can tell that there was so much magnetic field in between. That's Faraday rotation. And in the CMB, it will convert E modes to B modes. And of course, it'll again be frequency dependent. So in different bands, you will see different different pattern of B modes. So it's frequency dependent. And it would be correlated with the temperature fluctuations. And for the kind of spectra that we are talking about, it will grow at small angular scales. So this was, if we take a spectrum of this kind, where you have a long wavelength tail, then some flat distribution, and then a cutoff at some dissipation scale, and there are certain power laws for each of those three sections, then you can find CLBB, and what you find, so these are all the other contributions, but the magnetic field contribution would go up like this, and at some large L, would start dominating the other contributions. So if you want to look for magnetic fields in this way, you would like to go to very high L and look for BB. I don't know if that's possible, but that's one possibility. And using CLBB, we can put some constraints. And actually here, there are two parameters. One is, of course, the energy density in the magnetic field divided by the energy density in photons. And there's also this, this coherence scale which comes in. And BBN basically says that omega B gamma has to be less than, say, 0.1. And depending on the spectral indices, you can put different constraints. And this line is actually a theoretical line, which is that if you have magnetic fields, very incoherent magnetic fields, then they will dissipate by Alphen waves. And so there's a constraint. And it's a kind of a nonlinear constraint that the that it depends on the energy density and the inertial scale. So anyway, so there is a line here. But anyway, these are the sort of constraints right now. So we were able to produce these. And at least if at least on say 1 megaparsec scales, the magnetic field is less than. This is 10 to the minus 7. So this is like 10 to the minus 8 or so Gauss. So OK. So just to close up, I hope I've shown you that, that there is a tight connection between baryogenesis and magnetogenesis. Fields can still have interesting amplitudes, like more than 10 to the minus 21 Gauss, and maybe even up to 10 to the minus 11 Gauss. And the coherence scale is not like megaparsec scales, but maybe parsec or kiloparsec scales. And of course, if you detect these magnetic fields, then it might become a window to the electroweak phase transition and to baryogenesis. And perhaps TV gamma rays, cosmic rays, because there's some claim that the bending seen by the Auger, that the when they were correlating the cosmic rays with the AGNs, that there's some bending, so maybe there's a magnetic field there. And maybe the CMB can be used to probe these magnetic fields, which would be exciting. And of course, there are lots of open questions too, like how do magnetic fields evolve? And I'm not quite sure there's a closed answer yet, because there are all these different effects coming into play. And then what will future experiments do? Now there are experiments going to very high angular scales, very high Ls, the CMB experiments. The other question which I've been beating my head a little bit is how to detect the magnetic helicity. One can still think of ways of detecting magnetic fields, say in the CMB, et cetera. But how can you tell that it carries some handedness? with cosmic rays, we had an idea, Tina Kanyashvili and I, but it requires knowing the sources of the cosmic rays, and then you can construct a quantity that is sensitive to the helicity of the field. So this is an interesting question. Of course, there could be indirect detection, which means that the evolution of the magnetic field and the power law, the spectra, will depend on whether it is helical or not. And so if you detect the spectrum, then you might be able to say, oh, it looks like it's helical. And of course, a question which is kind of beyond the scope of my education is what are the implications if you have a strong, reasonably strong magnetic field on small scales? Does it have any astrophysical consequences for the first generation of stars, for example? Okay, thank you.
Questions for our topic?
Could you remind me what you mean by strong? When you say strong, small scale, is that
today, so the most optimistic scenario might be 10 to the minus 11 Gauss today. So that means, it means a little larger at structure formation.
For the large scales regarding the CFP, for the part of the rotation. Can you use this astrophysical sources for this measurement? For instance, quasars.
Oh, you mean whether there's some confusion because of them?
Yeah, I mean that for the large Ls, you have resolution problems. My question is why you are not using this astrophysical sources? For instance, we use the quasars.
I am, of course.
Or even 21 centimeter radiation of the hydrogen. Is it possible?
So that's a good question. I don't know. And maybe
it's yes. Ryan Gensler's group tries to do, I think it's 21 centimeter rotation measures. They get relatively small rotation measures, so it's a very challenging thing.
Sorry, whose group is that?
Ryan Gensler. Super Australian China.
Okay.
So cosmologists like to play with various neutrino chemical potentials, lepton symmetry.
Yes.
Since they're coupled by weak interactions to electrons and positrons, there should be implications for electron nucleosynthesis and possibly alteration of this Rayleigh scale.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you very well. But you were saying that the neutrinos.
Well, if there is a neutrino, I said it earlier, say a synergy between neutrinos and antineutrinos, and there's also a synergy between this.
Yes.
Because they interact with the.
Yes.
Before annihilation, they're coupled to
yes.
The leptons. They would be probably. Implications for the handedness of levels
as well.
Would it modify anything in this scale at all?
Right. That's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure I know the answer completely, but say prior to electroweak phase transition, these could generate a hypercharge field, and that was current Joyce and Shaposhnikov were sort of along that. They assumed a field. But these effects prior to electroweak phase transition could produce a hypercharge field, and then the hypercharge field could get converted into an electromagnetic field. So that's something that I think deserves more investigation. Yeah. Good question.
So this Spellron picture, I mean, I haven't seen it before. Is this very well accepted? I mean, the whole idea that the solicity is connected to the variable genesis. Is that like your work, or is this just standard stuff?
It's my work. And also, see, the interpretation of a Sphaleron as the bounds, monopole, anti-monopole, was kind of got lost in the literature a little bit. The first paper was by Taubes, who was a mathematician, and maybe in communications of mathematical physics, where he was looking at an O3 model, and he found a monopole and an anti-monopole bound state solution in unstable equilibrium. He used some Morse, I think he used Morse theory argument, I'm not quite sure. But anyway, but Nick Manton then used that, applied it to the electroweak model, and got the Sphaleron. So those are very mathematical. Basically it was he was using Taubes' analysis that he used for the monopole antimonopole. I think he mentioned the monopole antimonopole in the introduction, but he doesn't really make use of it anywhere. Nambu, of course, had the monopole solution, or not the solution, but the monopole configuration in the electroweak model. And then quite a bit later, I sort of reinterpreted the Sphaleron as the monopole antimonopole. And then Mark Hindmarsh also had pictures of the electromagnetic field with its twist. And then most recently, we've looked at the decay and actually calculated the helicity. So it's a few people who like to tinker with these things.
When did Vikram Soni's Sphaleron come in?
Vikram Soni in the late 80s, he had a paper. I knew that paper reasonably well, but now I'm having trouble. I think it was in the late 80s.
That's right.
So he also had a paper following up on Nambu's paper on describing electroweak magnetic monopoles. Yeah.
Back to this question on how to detect velocity, magnetic velocity. I imagine someone already asked what just a spherical rotation might induce some cross-correlation of like TV or something?
No, it doesn't. You see, the magnetic helicity has to do with three dimensions, because it's basically the linking of magnetic lines. If one way to think about it is this. But no two-dimensional or one-dimensional projection will ever tell you whether the field lines are linked. And the Faraday rotation is a line of sight, only gives you the line of sight component. It doesn't give you the 3D information. So that's why Faraday rotation by itself cannot tell you, and I think I made this mistake once, is that I thought that there'd be correlations of Faraday rotation that would tell you the helicity. But if you have cosmic rays which are coming and then bending, then they are sensitive to the other components, and that can tell you whether there's helicity or not.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.